Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, state lawmakers rejoice over landmark education reform that was years in the making.
There was never the sense that it wasn't going to get done. The speaker always knew that it was going to get done. It was in the fine-tuning of the details. These formulas are really complicated.
And tomorrow is Thanksgiving, but hundreds of Native Americans will observe the 50th annual National Day of Mourning in Plymouth. Also today, U.S. former poet laureate Robert Pinsky on poetry at the extremes of human emotion. Plus, a group of teenagers from Lunenburg is raising money to build a skate park in their town.
We didn't assume it would get this big. Now we have furthered our expectations. We're looking at around a total of $400,000 to make this a destination park, not just a local park.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Finally, after years of debate, Massachusetts has a new education funding formula. Here's Governor Baker as he signed the Student Opportunities Act yesterday, which is the first major overhaul of school funding since 1993, and is expected to pump billions of dollars into the state's public schools.
Every kid in the Commonwealth of Mass, regardless of where they live, where they go to school, has the opportunity to get the education that they need to be great.
WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin has been following this story, and he joins us now here in Studio 3. Welcome, Max.
Hi, Tiziana.
So what does the Student Opportunities Act do?
Yeah, it's funny, Tiziana. I got an email this morning saying, well, it would be really nice if you could explain what's in this bill. And I've been I've been covering it for so long that I forget that people might not know. I think that's in part because this measure is a little bit hard to explain, but I'm going to give it a try. So you have 26 years ago, the state comes up with this formula that's supposed to calculate a kind of minimum that any school district should be spending based on the students that they teach on their schools. That's their so-called foundation budget. And based on how tax-rich that town might be, the state covers some part of that amount, could be 17% up to 82%. That formula never got updated in a comprehensive way. And so at a certain point, it was way behind where costs had gone. Healthcare and special education have outpaced what that minimum calculated. This bill makes that update, I should say this new law, and then most significantly, the law takes into account that funding should be much higher, as much as two times as high, for districts with the highest concentration of low-income students. So they could end up with thousands more dollars for each of those students. You think of, you know, cities like Springfield, Revere, Lynn. They've been really struggling to cover their bills. This bill aims to help them implement reforms that are costly but have been shown to work with those students, so extending the school day or adding support staff, social workers, that kind of thing.
Okay. Is there anything the law doesn't do?
Yeah. I think it's worth noting that it doesn't come with a whole bunch of regulatory teeth. The last time, 1993, there was an ed funding deal on this scale. Schools got a lot more money, but they also got the MCAS test, this mandatory high-stakes test, as a way to sort of monitor their progress. And then they also got competition in the form of public charter schools that would be angling for their students. This bill has a sort of softer approach to accountability, in part because its supporters were able to argue that the state already does a lot to keep schools honest. If it's struggling, they can close a school, take it over, lay off a whole bunch of teachers, that kind of thing.
All right. So we know that the $1.5 billion in new funding is really important. You've talked about this softer set of accountability. Are there other issues it's important to understand that the law addresses?
Yeah, it's not as if this is a blank check. There are some accountability measures in the bill. So, for instance, each district is going to have to submit a plan every 3 years to the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education that explains what they're trying to accomplish, how they're spending the new money. The Commissioner of Education can review those plans. Republicans, even force a redraft if he isn't satisfied with where they're at. And then this bill also sets up sort of a side pot of money where districts can apply for grants if they want to try something new. And there's also money set aside to sort of share those results. Finally, there's an interesting provision, kind of a small part of the bill, but it will allow the governor's education secretary to gather data on how the state's high school graduates are doing after they graduate. So how are they doing in college? How many credits are they taking? You know, how are they faring in the workforce? And that really hasn't been done before, and I think it could generate some pretty interesting data.
This has to essentially have been a triumph for state legislators after 26 years. What are they saying?
Yeah, there was some big old pat on the back at this ceremony yesterday. I mean, the thing sailed through after years and years of delay and perplexity, I think. There was not a single no vote against this bill, and that goes for across houses, across parties. Yeah, multiple votes. This thing was, you know, had the sanction of the entire body. But there was a debate beneath the surface about how to make sure that the new money that would be pumped into schools would be spent in an efficient way. And I don't think that part of the debate is going away. You heard Representative Alice Peisch from Wellesley at yesterday's ceremony kind of sound that note. She said, "Lots to celebrate here, but make no mistake, this is a beginning of a difficult period, and there's a hard part yet to come."
Accountability is not a dirty word. It is the mechanism by which we ensure that the funding we provide is spent in a way that benefits the students for whom it was intended.
So Alice Peisch will certainly have an ally on that score in Governor Baker. He's a big supporter of accountability. He threw all his weight behind the expansion of charter schools in 2016. That measure went down in defeat. And now it feels like he's got to have some leverage back so he can go to schools and say, "Hey, listen, I sent a bunch of money your way. Let's see some change."
So we got to ask, you know, people have been upset about the impact of the state funding formula for a long time. Yes, no votes against it this year, but 26 years. What took so long?
Yeah, I think that's a topic of some debate, too, Tiziana. It is a very complex formula, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I think it's worth remembering that a similar bill fell apart at the last minute in the summer of 2018. And a few things have happened since then. You had Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz give up her seat as co-chair of the state's Joint Education Committee. You had Jason Lewis, a senator from Winchester, came in. A new version of the bill, by the way, had Marty Walsh step in and support it. I think that's an important point. And then you had turnover in House leadership. For example, Jeff Sanchez, the former chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Last fall, Sanchez was narrowly defeated in a primary by Nika Eligardo, who made this bill and the fact that Sanchez seemingly didn't quite push it through last session, she made that a big part of her campaign. So I spoke to Sanchez. He kind of downplayed the idea that his primary defeat played a role in scaring legislators, maybe getting this bill through. He said lawmakers were working hard throughout, and they just happened to run out of time last session.
There was never the sense that it wasn't going to get done. The speaker always knew that it was going to get done. It was in the fine-tuning of the details. These formulas are really complicated. I mean, imagine they take into consideration, you know, area wages, property values, taxes, race, ethnicity. I mean, there's all these different pieces that go into it.
So that's the legislators. What about the state's education community? What do they have to say now that the bill's been signed?
Yeah, I think they feel especially jubilant when you – that's what you get from organizers with parents groups and teachers unions. But they are also adamant that they think advocacy, even some anger, played a big role here. I spoke to Charlotte Kelly. She's head of the Mass Education Justice Alliance, which was maybe the most prominent group in that Fund Our Future campaign. She thought this was less a matter of fine-tuning, getting to the right bill, and more a question of political will.
The legislature has known for 5 going on 6 years what the problem is. For us, the pushback that we were receiving from legislators from the beginning was, this is too much to pay for.
And yeah, Tiziana, like the predecessor bill in 1993, this bill does not come with a new source of revenue. Governor Baker has already started to argue that in implementing this ambitious new law between now and 2026, mind you, that should take precedence over any other big spending proposals.
Okay, you mentioned State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz. We're going to speak with her in just a moment. She's advocated for this bill or similar bills for a number of years through her role as the co-chair of the state's Joint Education Committee, which up until this year, she had that role. How does this bill include or expand on the work that she did?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Because Sonia Chang-Diaz wasn't the co-chair when this went over the line, there's a risk that her role in pushing it over could be lost to history somehow. I think whatever your theory of why it passed this session, whether it's about the tweaks of the technical details or the political ambition or the tone in the State House, I think Sonia Chang-Diaz is the single most important person in a kind of cast of thousands in getting this thing passed, because it was her who pointed out with some urgency and over the course of several years now that districts like the ones we mentioned at the top of this segment, Brockton, Lynn, Revere, Worcester, they, you know, districts that might have a lot of immigrants but not much in the way of tax revenue, they were just struggling to pay their bills, let alone give their kids the resources they needed to help them thrive. And that vision made it into this final version of the bill and has now passed into law. So I'm very interested to hear what she has to say.
Okay, so stay with us for a minute, Max. State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz does join us on the line now. Welcome, State Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So now that the bill has become law, what's your reaction?
I'm thrilled. I'm pumped. I'm overcome. Representative Pleisch, Sherwin Pleisch, said yesterday, there's also a ton of work ahead for the state and for districts. So I'm excited and anxious about the work ahead. But, you know, just to pause and celebrate this moment, it is a, you know, generational level law that got signed into the books yesterday, and it has been the product of, as Max said, a cast of thousands who have been lifting the set of reforms up high for the last couple of years. So I am truly thrilled.
And it has been a cast of thousands, but you've been in the state Senate for a decade and have always had an eye toward education equity. You were a vocal advocate for school funding reform as co-chair of the Joint Committee on Education. This bill, the Student Opportunity Act, which is now law, does it achieve what you had hoped to achieve during the time you were pushing for a bill, for a law?
Absolutely, without question. You know, I look back at the a year ago, almost this past January, when a coalition of educators, Republicans, Democrats, community organizers, business leaders, you know, parents, students, you name it, came together to launch the Promise Act, which was a sort of, you know, precursor bill to this law. There were four or five key things that that coalition articulated that we wanted to see passed into law in 2019, and this bill checks all of those boxes. It includes all five of the recommendations of the Foundation Budget Review Commission from back in 2015, including and especially, as Max, to his great credit, has noted, the provisions for low-income equity, which was a huge sticking piece last year. And this bill really goes the full distance in following the research where it points us that we need to, in the case of our most impoverished districts, double the funding that we are committing to closing those opportunity and achievement gaps. So the law goes the distance there. It commits us to fully and accurately counting how many low-income students are even sitting in our schools, which seems like a simple thing, but is actually something we have been getting wrong for the last few years. It also recommits the state to fully funding our charter mitigation promise from a few years ago, which we've been falling down on. And it puts in place, you know, an equal system for how we're doing accountability across all districts, rather than having sort of different systems for different kinds of districts. So those were the criteria that we articulated, and I'm thrilled to say that it does all of that and more.
I want to jump in there. You mentioned last year a couple of times. It got close last year, but fell apart last minute. What got it over the finish line this year that is different from last year?
So I would say a few things. One, time really makes a difference, right? That this, as Max has seen up close and personal for the last several years, it is a complicated issue, and there are 200 members of the legislature, and not all of them live and breathe education policy every day. So just the having another year and a half worth of time for that organizing and educating work to take place, to continue to build the coalition so that more and more legislators were continuing to hear from their constituents about the things that they wanted to see in a bill, about the urgency with which their communities needed that. And that's why we have, you know, we we had over half, well over half, of both the House and the Senate co-sponsoring the Promise Act early in the session, and that was a new threshold for us. And just the organizing outside of the building has been incredible to watch. You know, I chaired the Education Committee for 8 years, and constituency groups that normally, at best, don't get along with one another very well, were coming together in a unified way behind this bill. You know, folks, whether it's, you know, teachers' unions and charter school proponents, or business leaders and municipal officials, there was an incredible amount of unity that this was the number one thing that we needed to get done next in education policy, and that it needed to be something that was generational in size and not just nibbling around the edges.
All right. That is Massachusetts Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thanks again for having me, Tiziana, and thanks again to Max for his incredible coverage of this issue over the years.
WBUR's Max Larkin is still with us in the studio. Max, just quickly, what's your reaction to what we just heard from the state senator?
Well, when I was speaking to Jeff Sanchez, again, whatever your theory, he said this is a civics lesson. And I think it is that. Well, you know, this was something that people decided was worth doing, that needed to happen, had been put off for too long, and they were able to come together across a lot of lines and make it happen. So it's exciting to see what will happen next.
WBUR EDIFY reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we've talked a lot about Thanksgiving on the show over the last week. Last Friday, we heard from one woman who volunteers handing out turkeys to families in need. Yesterday, we got a crash course in all things pie. But we also wanted to make sure that we highlighted another and sadly darker side of the holiday, which is its history. Tomorrow, hundreds of Native Americans will gather in Plymouth for the 50th annual National Day of Mourning, a day intended to separate truth from myth. To learn more, we spoke to Keisha James. She is an enrolled member of the Wampanoag Tribe, president of Wellesley College's Native American Student Association, and she's the granddaughter of the founder of the National Day of Mourning. And she told us it's an incredibly meaningful day for Native Americans, especially here in New England.
It's the only day out of the 365 days of the year that we have where us Native Americans have a chance to talk about the issues that are affecting us. Especially in the New England area, we're very much erased. A lot of people think we went extinct or that, you know, all the real Indians died off. So it's a very important day because it gives us a chance to talk about the issues affecting us and also just increase awareness about our existence in the area.
So, for the people who haven't been or maybe have never even heard of the National Day of Mourning, can you walk us through the day, how you'll spend it? I've heard you refer to it as a protest.
Yes. So for some people, National Day of Mourning has a religious significance where they'll fast before National Day of Mourning. But for many of us, it is a protest, protesting the continuous lies that are being told to school children and just the public in general about Thanksgiving, and also protesting the general conditions that Indigenous people endure in this country and around the world. So National Day of Mourning begins at noon. We open with a prayer. And that's followed by speeches made by only Indigenous people, because only Indigenous people are allowed to give speeches on National Day of Mourning, because it's one day when we won't be spoken for. And then following the speeches, we have a march. We usually march down to Plymouth Rock and talk about the truth about Plymouth Rock and what it represents, because Plymouth Rock, the pilgrims didn't even land on Plymouth Rock. It was actually just a random rock that was chosen and then brought down to the waterfront and sort of had this whole mythology constructed around it. So we talk about that. And then we march up to Post Office Square in Plymouth, where there's a plaque commemorating National Day of Mourning, which we got as part of a 1998 settlement with the town of Plymouth. And then following that, we have a social. It's a potluck dinner. We have many, many wonderful kitchen volunteers who spend the days leading up to National Day of Mourning preparing for this dinner. And at this meal, it's just a chance for us to sit down, talk to one another, get to know each other, sort of foster a community.
Keisha, do you happen to know roughly how many people attend the National Day of Mourning?
Attendance has gone up quite a bit in recent years, where we have anywhere between 700 to 1,200 people. This year, there might be more because it is the 50th, but if it rains, then that tends to change the numbers.
Keisha, what is the truth about Thanksgiving? What do we misteach, and what true history have we forgotten or erased?
Currently, we teach, and I think everyone's taught a slightly different version of the myth, but the myth that I was taught in school when I was younger is that the pilgrims, seeking religious freedom, landed on Plymouth Rock, and then the Indians welcomed them with open arms, saved them from starvation, and to celebrate it, they all sat down and had a Thanksgiving feast together, and then the Indians conveniently faded into the background, and everybody lived happily ever after. But it is important to note that the pilgrims didn't actually come here to seek religious freedom. People tend to mistake the pilgrims with the Puritans. The pilgrims already had religious freedom where they came from. The pilgrims were here as part of a commercial venture. When they arrived, and they arrived on Outer Cape Cod, not in Plymouth, by the way, one of the first things they did was rob my ancestors' graves at Cornhill and steal as much of their winter provisions as they were able to take. And then the Wampanoag did welcome them. That part of the myth is true. And the Wampanoag did save them from starvation. And in return for this kindness, the Wampanoag got, you know, genocide, theft of lands, never-ending repression. And the other important thing to remember is that the first Thanksgiving didn't take place in 1621 when the pilgrims had a harvest time meal with the Wampanoag. Instead, it was actually officially proclaimed in 1637 to celebrate the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children on the banks of the Connecticut River.
David Silverman talked with Morning Edition about his book, This Is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth County, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. And he talks about the treatment of the body of a tribal leader in another bloody conflict between the people of Plymouth and native peoples during that same era.
After they killed him, they dismembered his body, they decapitated his head, and they piked it outside the gates of Plymouth and left it there to rot for 20 years as a symbol of their victory. And then after that activity, Plymouth and Massachusetts colonies held days of Thanksgiving in praise of God for saving them from their enemies.
And we'll have that full interview with David Silverman tomorrow morning on WBUR's Morning Edition. Is that the truth we need to be teaching about what happened in the early years after the pilgrims came to the United States?
I do think it is the truth that we should be teaching. We should be teaching what happened to Massasoit and the Wampanoag people and the real savagery that was brought over to these shores and the legacy of the pilgrims, because we always say that the pilgrims brought with them homophobia, a class system, jails, all sorts of things to these shores. So I think it's very important to talk about what really happened to the Wampanoag.
I would ask, Keisha, were there any positives that came out of those early interactions between your people and the European settlers? Technologies, tools, trade, anything good in your mind that came out of those early interactions?
One of the most common arguments I hear is that, you know, it can't have been all bad for the Wampanoag because the European settlers brought with them technologies and guns and things like that. So, you know, we should be thanking the settlers for technological progress. But I don't think anything positive came out of the early interactions with the Wampanoag and the pilgrims because, you know, technological advances are great. But if you're trading technological advances with genocide, then I don't think anything good can come out of an early interaction.
So Thanksgiving is a holiday celebrated across the country. People enjoy the food, the family. Often they're not focused on the historical anchoring of the holiday, but instead who they're with and what they're grateful for. How do you reflect on Thanksgiving as it's celebrated today?
So I don't have anything against Thanksgiving as a holiday. I think it's great that people get together with family and friends and reflect on what they're thankful for, because I don't think we reflect on that often enough. The part that I object to is the Thanksgiving myth, because I think right now in America, the Thanksgiving myth and Thanksgiving are actually inseparable, because the Thanksgiving myth is really hammered into school children and just in culture in general. And so I just really object to people perpetuating the Thanksgiving myth in the same way that I object to Columbus Day and people perpetuating the Columbus myth as well. But I don't have anything against a holiday like Thanksgiving.
Yesterday, we spoke with Cedric Cromwell, the chairman of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, and he corrected our understanding of the first encounter that we often think of as that first Thanksgiving. Here he is.
Chief Usamequin, our great Santium. You know, Massasoit is the title that means great chief, but it was Usamequin, Yellowfeather, sent 90 men over to the first settlers and said to check on them and see why they had so many guns out and weapons and practiced in arms and target practice. And, you know, they decided, our people, along with the settlers, decided to sit down and talk about why everybody was taking up arms. And it was a sit-down of peace and prosperity because the first settlers were planning to kill and destroy our people. And, you know, the first settlers sat down with our tribal warriors and talked about peace, how we work together. And it was fish, fowl and pheasant, and shellfish and venison.
So if we had understood that this first meal was about avoiding massacre, and that some 15 years later, in fact, a massacre did happen, how do you think we would be celebrating Thanksgiving today?
I think we wouldn't be celebrating Thanksgiving as it's understood today, because although the first Thanksgiving, as Cedric Cromwell described, was about peace, at the same time, the Wampanoag already knew what the European settlers were going to do to them. So they already knew that it wasn't truly about peace, I think. So I don't think the first Thanksgiving was actually about peace. And I think if people understood that, then the mythology just wouldn't have come into being in the first place.
So the word celebrating wouldn't even be in the lexicon. There might be something we would observe.
Yes.
Keisha, in addition to correcting our understanding of the history of Thanksgiving, you've said that the National Day of Mourning is also meant to raise attention about issues that Native people face in the United States. What are some of those issues?
The issues that we are really going to be talking about this year at National Day of Mourning and the issues that we really, really care about this year are, first and foremost, missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirits, which some of your listeners may have heard of because it's getting a little more national attention now. But essentially, there's a silent crisis going on in this country where Indigenous people are being murdered and going missing at extremely high rates, and law enforcement and governmental officials in general just haven't been responsive enough, and they don't seem to care enough. So we're really trying to raise the visibility of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We're also going to be talking a lot about the Keystone XL pipeline as well as other pipelines. And then the last big issue we're really focusing on this year is ICE, because we as Indigenous people are...
ICE as in Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
Yes, specifically ICE detaining migrant children at the border, because we as Indigenous people are painfully aware of the U.S. government's history of separating children from their families, and specifically Indigenous children from their families. You know, our children were taken from us and put in residential schools, the last of which closed in 1996. So this is still a very fresh wound for us. And down at the border, many of those children are from Indigenous families. And so we just see this as sort of an extension of the U.S. government's separation policies against Indigenous people.
Those are deeply troubling and challenging issues, Keisha.
Yes.
You've also said a couple of times today that it's important for people to take time for gratitude and that we don't do it enough. Is there anything you're particularly grateful for this year?
I'm grateful that I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm not in a, you know, in a cage this Thanksgiving. And I'm particularly grateful that my ancestors were able to survive colonization and U.S. imperialism and everything like that, and that I'm still able to be here today. And that's something that I give thanks for not only on Thanksgiving, but every day. So those are the things that I'm particularly grateful for this year.
And Keisha, is there something listeners today, for example, could or should do differently or in addition when observing Thanksgiving this year that you might recommend or call people to?
Yeah, I do think there are some things that you can do on Thanksgiving. I think the first thing is to learn about the true history and educate yourself. You know, if you're a parent, sit your children down and explain to them what happened at the real Thanksgiving. You know, you don't have to go into all the gory and graphic details, but I think young children are able to handle a lot more than we think they can. And I think it's important to start young, teaching them the true history. You can also, if you have a school-aged child, maybe think about start advocating for a more inclusive curriculum and a more truthful curriculum about Native American issues. If your school child dressed up in a pageant, as many do in this state, consider talking to your school district about that, to your child's teacher about that, to try to get that aspect of pageantry removed from the curriculum. But in general, I just think people should really sit down before they celebrate Thanksgiving and just educate themselves on the true history of Thanksgiving, just so that they understand why the myth is so harmful.
And lastly, Keisha, I want to ask you, your grandfather, Wamsutta Frank James, founded the National Day of Mourning 50 years ago. If he were still with us, what do you think he'd say today?
I think he would be proud that we had continued his tradition for 50 years, which is no small feat, especially when National Day of Mourning sort of began as a very controversial counterculture movement that a lot of people violently hated. So I think it's a big deal that we're still here. But I do think that he would be saddened that many of the issues that were prevalent in Indian country are unfortunately still prevalent today. They still aren't solved. Our suicide rates still are highest in the nation than they were in 1970. And our life expectancy is still lower than all of the other races in America. And that was the same in 1970. And our, you know, education levels are still lowest in the nation, things like that. So I think he would be a little dismayed that we haven't made more progress as a society, but I do think that he would be proud that we have continued National Day of Mourning.
That was Keisha James, an enrolled member of the Wampanoag tribe, president of Wellesley College's Native American Student Association, and granddaughter of the founder of the National Day of Mourning. Stay with us. Coming up, former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky on poetry at the extremes of human emotion. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. A group of teenagers in a small town in central Massachusetts are raising money to open a skate park in their community. For now, they have to come into Boston for serious skating. Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell met up with the group.
Even in the middle of the week, the 40,000 square foot Lynch Family Skate Park in East Cambridge is crowded. I'm with five 14-year-olds who drove over an hour from Lunenburg to skate for the afternoon. What trick is that?
Kickflip.
Kickflip. Lunenburg, population 11,000, is one of the state's fastest-growing municipalities, according to 2018 census estimates. And there's not enough for teenagers to do, at least according to Mason Wickham.
In terms of like things for that people like youth can do, there aren't many options.
Especially on skateboards. These boys say they mostly rely on empty school parking lots to practice. Here's Aiden Swift.
And when there's people there, they don't really like us skating. So, like, we get moved off. And so we're just jumping from spot to spot, and we just want a place to skate, like, designated for skating.
In a school parking lot one day, the teenagers say they dreamed up an alternative. Here's Wickham again.
Imagine if in that grass field, like 100 feet to the right of us, there was just a skate park we could go to after school for like hours on end. And we were just kind of throwing ideas out there. And eventually, I mean, now here we are making it happen.
This group, as a part of an eighth grade class project, nurtured that idea into an actual proposal. They presented it to their board of selectmen in March 2018. And 2 years later, it's become a massive fundraising effort for them. Griffin Cayozo says he wants the project to put Lunenburg on the radar for skaters everywhere.
We were planning to get a plot of land, raise around $12,000, and start building. Now we have furthered our expectations. We're looking at around a total of $400,000 to make this a destination park.
The town of Lunenburg did donate land to the project, but the teens are raising the money completely independently. Cayozo says they're about a fourth of the way there.
We feel that's going pretty steadily. We're at around $60,000 right now, with around $40,000 promised.
They hope to start building the 10,000 square foot park next summer, though it may not be completed until after they graduate high school. Wickham says he wants it to be a place for everyone, young and old, to be able to get the same rush he does from skating.
You're competing against yourself to do something that you weren't able to do last week. Like, you're pushing yourself to finish this trick that you've been working on for months. So the ability to really see that progress in front of you is really, really, it's a great thing.
I asked another member of the group, Chris Roy, what he loves about skating. He says this project is about something else entirely.
I don't really skate that often, but...
What? So why are you involved in the project if you're not even really a skateboarder?
Well, it's not just about skating. It's about showing kids that they can do something in their town and they can make things happen.
That story from Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell.
Oh, the mind. Mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. This is a line from a sonnet by Gerard Manley Hopkins. It's from his poem, No Worst, There Is None. That phrase, the mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, profoundly affected Robert Pinsky. He's the former poet laureate of the United States, and his latest anthology is titled The Mind Has Cliffs of Fall, Poems at the Extremes of Feeling. Every poem in the collection reveals something about the vastness and intensity of human emotion. Pinsky is currently the director of the Creative Writing Program at Boston University, and he joins us now in Studio 3. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, pleasure to be here, Tiziana.
We're glad to have you. And we'd like you to join Robert and me at the table. Do you read poetry? If you don't, why not? Have you come across some poem in your life that really captures one of your life's extreme moments? Call us and share it with us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Robert, where did you first get the idea for this particular anthology?
Well, I did do this favorite poem project where we have the videos at favoritepoem.org. It's the famous video of the construction worker reading Whitman and the Cambodian immigrant reading a Langston Hughes poem, relating it to her family's experience in Cambodia.
And you did that while you were poet laureate.
Yeah,
right?
And it's still going on. You can watch the videos at favoritepoem.org. And at some point I realized that people love, it's very similar to the appeal of professional wrestling or Shakespeare or
I
murder
I did not
mysteries.
See the wrestling thing coming.
Oh, yeah. People like, we like sex and violence. And that comes at all kinds of levels. And extremes cheer us up. And if it's an extreme of despair or suffering, it also cheers us up, not because simply it's not us, but there's something about the exuberance of saying there is no worst, says Hopkins. And in the letters, we got those tens of thousands of people writing to the Favorite Poem Project, you realize that... Like other arts, and yes, professional wrestling, Shakespeare, football, we like to see things at the extreme.
How much of our time do you think, or of our lives, do you think we spend at the extremes of feeling?
We're craving them all the time. The most obvious example is sexual feeling. But if you are raised an infant, if you deal with toddlers, they want more and the most. And it's certainly true of me.
I thought when I first started the book that it would be a lot to ask someone to go through this anthology and stay at the bleeding edge of emotion for all of that time. It didn't feel like it, reading the poems, but I wondered if it was a lot to ask of you as you put the anthology together.
It was totally pleasurable.
Was it?
It was just fun all the way through and a kind of cackle. I don't know if the story is true about Dickens chuckling and slapping his leg when he wrote The Death of Little Nell, but there is that feeling, ha-ha, this is really as bad as it can be.
I have to admit, when I tell stories of sort of some of the worst things in my life years later, I almost always laugh my head off when I tell them.
Yeah, they're very close. Crying and laughing, famously, are very close to one another. And I was very glad to have the last section of this, after sections called Grief and Despair, to have the last section be Manic Laughter.
That's a good point. So I know there's a story behind the book, behind the title, The Mind Has Cliffs of Fall. We heard a little bit about the provenance of that at the top. You took it from a line from Gerard Manley Hopkins. Why pick it? What does the phrase mean to you? Why did it represent all you wanted to capture in this anthology?
It's those absolutes. He's like Emily Dickinson in that. It's all. It's everything. And the first one-syllable words in that first line begins, "No worst, there is none," in case you didn't get it the first time. No worst, there is none.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there is something terrific about that, and you can see how it would be a great comfort to this Catholic convert, never expecting to publish poetry, alienated his parents by converting. He's homosexual. He feels very lonely and very unhappy with himself. Easy to picture how he would just be thrilled to say, this is beyond fathoming.
Let's have you read it. It's in a section titled Despair.
No worst, there is none. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is your relief? My cries heave herds long, huddle in a mane, a chief woe, world sorrow, on an age-old anvil wince and sing, then lull, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering. Let me be fell, force I must be brief. Oh, the mind, mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap may, who ne'er hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep.
It really comes forward in a different way when you read it out loud, doesn't it?
When anyone reads it out loud, that's the whole favorite poem project idea is, it's a vocal art, but not a performer's art. Anybody at all reads those lines. When you get to an age-old anvil, wince and sing. It's such a great phrase, and it's the equivalent of tasting good.
Let's bring some other people into the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom in Manchester, pull up a chair. What do you want to share with Robert Pinsky?
Hiya, Tom.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I've always liked the poem Sea Fever by John Masefield.
Uh-huh.
I worked on ships for a number of years, and some of the last bands always spoke to me about,
yes,
must go down to the seas again, to the vagrant gypsy life.
Do you live near the ocean now?
I do. I live in Manchester, Massachusetts, and I went to sea for about 20 years.
That's great.
I always liked that. It somehow spoke to me about life as a seaman.
Let's hear it.
Oh, I don't know if Tom has it with him. Did he catch you by surprise, Tom, or do you have it?
I have the poem. Yeah, I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by, and the wheels kick and the wind song and the white sail shaking and the gray mist on the sea's face and the gray dawn breaking. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. And all I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying and the flung spray and the blown spume and the seagulls crying. I must go down to the seas again, to the vagrant gypsy life, to the gull's way and the whale's way, where the wind is like a whetted knife. And all I ask is a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover and a quiet sleep and a sweet dream when the long trick's over.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it.
Thank you so much.
That was great, Tom. Thank you.
So one of the things that strikes me, so Tom, there was a reason that poem resonated with him. As I went through this book, Robert, there are hundreds of years worth of poems and poets, from people born 15, 20 years ago to people born centuries ago. How did you even start to figure out where to look and what to choose in building this anthology?
There's a passage I'm thinking about in That Awful Man, where he said many good things about poetry, Ezra Pound. He's teaching, somebody's teaching a sailor, Virgil. He's learning Latin. And but the guy is also reading some book about an archduke. And the punchline of this story, I won't try to tell, is, I never was a duke. And he likes reading about, so I've never been down to the sea in ships. I grew up on the ocean, but it was more of a resort town. I've been down to the boardwalk. And hearing Tom read that poem, I could feel it in his voice, and I could hear that. And my favorite parts of the poem were kind of extreme. This is when Masefield is really talking, and he ends with death. He ends with the long journey over. I think it's a weird thing. We crave, my joke about movies sometimes, I'll watch any movie as long as it's not about a poet or a teacher. I like movies about cowboys and gangsters. And that's sort of true of all of us, I think, that we like just something we don't know about. And then there's also, as Tom said, something that is quite familiar to you. So I found when I was choosing poems for the book, it was much more like ordering ice cream or feeling cloth. When Hopkins says the anvil wince and sing, it seems so great for hitting an angle that it winces and sings. And, you know, I never was a Catholic. I'm not a homosexual. I'm not a 19th century lonely convert. But he speaks to me. I the anvil wince and sing, and I'm thrilled. I want to read it again.
I'd love to have you read one that really spoke to me, and it's about a father, and I'm not a father. It's from the Love and Rage section.
This is a poem that we got so many letters about.
Did you?
For favoritepoem.org, from people of all ages, races, etc. If you go to BUEDU, Art of Poetry, one word, you'll see people like Mel King. We have a series of people reading parts of this poem.
It's called Those Winter Sundays.
One of the poems people liked the best.
Will you read it?
Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
You know, you didn't read that. You recited that. I think you only looked at the page like twice.
Yeah, it's the poem, as poems can do. It got under my skin and into my ear. And I'm feeling the emotion when I'm saying it, and I don't need to read it. Yeah, it is a poem. I confess, you're right, Tiziana. I do know the poem by heart. And it's funny about things we know. It's like we have true of movies and music. Every time it's new, and every time that cold world offices at the end of the poem. I've sometimes said it's like being stabbed with an icicle. Offices, one of the most dull words in the language.
I never think of my loving attitudes or acts towards my family as my offices.
Yeah, and this man, that guy who banked the fires, and what house doesn't have its chronic angers?
Yeah.
It's really a great poem.
How did curating these poems, reflecting on these poems, let me backtrack. One of the things that's striking is with each poem, you have a little introduction where you pull out words that you want the reader to engage with. So you were really re-engaging with content, with language. Has it affected your poetry writing since you made the anthology?
It encourages me. It encouraged me to put together poems that I love so much and to arrange them in each section from something very old, like a folk poem or anonymous, to some kid I don't know who's 30 years old, I now call 30-year-olds kids. And it made me eager to write and read, and I came to love the game of making the headnotes really, really short.
They were.
Between two words and 30 words, most of them.
They were almost poems themselves.
I love thinking, thank you. And I love thinking, hey, this is like listening to music or eating good food or seeing a picture on the wall. You don't need some professor to yak and yak and yak and yak at you about these. So I tried to write head notes as though I was talking to somebody I know well and like talking to my wife or a grandkid and saying, hey, look at this. The Robert Hayden note is what it says. Austere in offices, the ardor of cold words, the beautiful formality of no one as distinct from the more colloquial nobody. I think it's great that this is no one ever thanked him. I think times I had the poem by heart, I mistakenly said nobody. He's keeping it a little more ceremonial than that, which is beautiful.
It's all beautiful. That's Robert Pinsky. He's a former poet laureate of the United States and the director of the creative writing program at Boston University, and he recently edited an anthology called The Mind Has Cliffs of Fall, Poems at the Extremes of Feeling. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
That's our show for today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.